Part 2. Victims. Identified victims. Timothy Jack McCoy. 3rd of January, 1972. Gacy's first known victim was 16-year-old Timothy Tim Jack McCoy, who he picked up at Chicago's Greyhound bus terminal. Tim had been visiting his aunt in Michigan and was making his way home to Glenwood, Iowa. Gacy had decided to drive into town to view ice sculptures after a family dinner when he spotted Tim and lured him into his car. He first took him on a sightseeing tour of Chicago and then invited him to relax at his house, promising to drop him off at the station the next morning in time for his bus. Gacy was married at the time, but his wife was away, so he took Tim home and had sex with him. He says they both fell asleep afterward. In the morning, when Gacy woke up, he saw Tim standing in his bedroom doorway with a knife and assumed that he was under attack, lunging at him in defense. They wrestled and Gacy's arm got cut by mistake in the tussle, which set him off. He smashed his head against the wall and kicked him against his wardrobe. Timothy fought back and kicked him in his stomach. When Gacy eventually got hold of the knife, he stabbed him twice in the chest, causing him to gurgle in agony, which Gacy said gave him a mind-numbing orgasm. "That's when I realized that death was the ultimate thrill," he said. This was the only victim that he ever stabbed. Quite odd considering how aroused he was by it. He rinsed the knife off in his bathroom, and as he entered the kitchen, he realized that Tim had not intended to attack him. The table was set for two, and there was a packet of unsliced bacon and an open carton of eggs on the counter. McCoy was waking Gacy up for a surprise breakfast and had carried the knife with him to the bedroom in a daze to call him. Gacy buried the body in his crawl space and decided to cover it in concrete when his wife started complaining about the odor coming from below. It ultimately took 14 years to identify him by dental records. He was last seen wearing a Model T Ford belt buckle, which also assisted in his identification. While he was initially buried as an unidentified victim with an anonymous gravestone in Chicago, he was transferred to Nebraska, where he was originally from, and buried there once he had been identified. His parents did not have the money for a funeral for him, so an airline and the funeral director picked up the tab and helped put Timothy to rest with dignity. Before his trip to Chicago for the holidays, he was working at Blue Star Foods with his cousin, who said that they were like brothers. When Timothy didn't return for work, the police and the FBI were immediately notified. When no information about him turned up, his cousin said, "We thought he had amnesia and just vanished. Some thought he might have been murdered, but nobody really knew." It was the chief of forensic science for the Cook County Sheriff's Department, Dr. John Pavlik, an Olympia Fields odontologist who identified McCoy by his dental records, saying, "The fillings he had were very, very unique. That would take him to 2 or 3% of the population. His fillings and teeth patterns were able to conclusively identify him as Gacy's first victim, which happened to be the ninth body that was exhumed from the crawlspace in 1978. He was buried in Westlawn Hillcrest Memorial Park in Omaha, Nebraska, with a beautiful golden memorial stone featuring mountains, pine trees, and a message: "Our beloved son and brother, Timothy Jack McCoy. Rest in peace, Tim. 14th of May, 1955 to the 3rd of January, 1972. Age 16. John Butkovich, 31st of July, 1975. 18-year-old John Butkovich disappeared on Thursday, July 31st, 1975, one day after he had confronted his boss, John Wayne Gacy, about an overdue paycheck with two of his friends. They argued over it, and Butkevich said that he wanted to quit and go to Puerto Rico. But Gacy reminded him that he owed him money for carpeting that he had in his apartment that he had charged to PDM's account. He said that he would have to work until the next payday and that he would need to reimburse him for the carpeting. The three of them left, with Butkevich still livid over the unpaid work he had done for Gacy. Later that evening, Gacy went cruising in Chicago and spotted Butkevich waving him down on the corner of West Lawrence Avenue. Butkevich had been in a fight, so he offered to drive him to his home to clean up his wounds. Once there, their argument about the paycheck resumed, and they had a drink, and Gacy cleaned his wounds. Butkevich started hitting him in frustration, so he decided to defuse the tension by showing him his handcuff trick. When Butkevich could not get himself out of them, he became enraged and screamed that he was going to kill him. Gacy got a rope, pushed him to the floor, sat on his chest for a while, and performed the rope trick. He watched as he struggled for air, convulsed on the floor and died, and then dragged his body to the garage where he planned to store him for a while. While he had planned to bury him in the crawl space, he had to improvise when his wife and stepdaughters returned home from a trip earlier than expected, quickly burying it in a hole that had been dug for a drain tile in the garage and covering it with concrete. Once Gacy had been arrested and a second search warrant had been signed, he was taken to his house to indicate where in the garage he had buried his body. He grabbed a can of orange spray paint and drew a stick figure on the ground, which showed the location and orientation of the body. When evidence technicians got to the body, his head was indeed in the direction that Gacy had indicated and was identified as John Butkevich, the second body found in the search. A piece of cloth had been lodged in his throat. He was one of the first victims to be identified by dental records on December 29, 1978. His father, Marko Butkevich, a Yugoslav immigrant, and his mother, Terezia, had called the police more than 100 times after his disappearance, always urging them to investigate Gacy further. He was buried at the Queen of Heaven Catholic Cemetery in Cook County, Illinois, with a beautiful tombstone engraved with his name, an angel, and "Eternal rest, grant unto them, O Lord." His father died in 1998 and was buried next to his son. His mother is still alive. Rest in peace, John Butkevich, 27th of August, 1956, to the 31st of July, 1975. Age 18. Daryl Julius Sampson, 6th of April, 1976. Daryl Julius Sampson was an energetic 19-year-old who told his parents and twin brother that he was moving to Libertyville to work at a carpeting company 600 plus miles or 950 plus kilometers away from home, where he could earn a decent income and hope to get married someday. Libertyville was only 27 miles from Chicago, and somehow Sampson crossed paths with Gacy in April of 1976. Gacy must have spotted him in Chicago on a cruise on Tuesday evening of April 6, 1976, which was just 1 month after his second divorce had been finalized. All that is known is that he was lured into his car with a shiny new job dangling under his nose, something that a young, blonde, ambitious man would be curious to explore. Based on the evidence, he died of asphyxiation and had a piece of cloth lodged in his throat. Gacy may have used his rope trick on him first and later stuffed the material in his mouth to prevent any leakage. His body was buried under Gacy's dining room floor, which shocked the police when they learned that they'd been having lunch in that location each day during the exhumation of the crawl space. There are very few photos available of this victim. If we analyze the most popular of the two pictures we find, it looks like the chain on his neck is that of a police mugshot. Gacy targeted boys who were hustlers, in trouble with the law, or up for some fun for a night, and perhaps he offered him some escapism from his problems. His mother, Dolores Vance, had reported him missing in several states and had visited Chicago on multiple occasions to tirelessly search for her son. "I wore blisters on the bottom of my feet. I burned up four cars trying to find him," she said. His mother knew in her gut that something was wrong. Her son had never been silent for more than a day or two. But police were adamant that he was just a runaway, a typical assumption at the time. His body was the last one found on Gacy's property, and it took 3 more years to conclusively identify him. He was buried in Home Oak Cemetery, Lake County, Illinois. Rest in peace, Daryl Julius Sampson. 6th of December, 1957, to the 6th of April, 1976. Age, 19. Randall Wayne Reffitt, 14th of May, 1976. On May 14th, 1976, a fine spring afternoon, 15-year-old Randall Reffitt was walking home from Senn High School, which is on the north side of Chicago, approximately 10 miles, 16 kilometers from Gacy's house, when he disappeared. Just a few hours later, a 14-year-old boy, Samuel Stapleton, disappeared on his way home from his sister's apartment in Chicago. Their bodies were found buried together in the crawl space in December 1978, and the bones had mangled together so badly that it was a challenge to separate and identify. There is no information available about how Gacy murdered these boys, but police are certain that both were killed on the same night, which Gacy called his doubles nights. Randall was buried slightly deeper than Samuel and was the 7th body to be exhumed from the crawl space. His remains were buried in Roseville Cemetery and Mausoleum in Chicago, Cook County, Illinois. He had 3 siblings, 2 brothers and 1 sister, and a big loving family, and was originally from Kentucky. Rest in peace, Randall Wayne Reffitt. 20th of September, 1960 to the 14th of May, 1976. Age, 15. Samuel G. Dodd Stapleton, 14th of May, 1976. 14-year-old Samuel Stapleton was walking home from his sister's apartment in Chicago on May 14, 1976, when he encountered 34-year-old John Wayne Gacy. There is no information about how he was lured into Gacy's car, but somehow he had ended up at his house at the same time as 15-year-old Randall Reffitt. If we speculate for a moment, Gacy likely lured them to his house under the pretense of a party or job opportunities. Stapleton was found buried in a layer of mud right above Reffitt in the crawl space and was the 6th body to be discovered in the exhumation process. He was identified through dental records on November 14, 1979. His remains were buried in Rose Hill Cemetery and Mausoleum in Chicago, Cook County, Illinois, in proximity to Reffitt. It is likely that he was a runaway or street hustler, and there is no information about his parents or family, and he had not been reported missing at the time. Rest in peace, Samuel G. Dodd Stapleton, 1961 to the 14th of May, 1976. Age, 14. Michael Bonin, 3rd of June, 1976. 17-year-old Michael Bonin was working on reconditioning an old jukebox for his uncle and was on his way to his house in Waukegan, Illinois to finish the job when he disappeared in Chicago on June the 3rd, 1976. At the time, he was working at a gas station and earning some extra money from odd jobs on weekends. Gacy lured him into his car, took him to his home, and the boy was never seen again. He was found buried in the crawl space under Gacy's spare bedroom, and his remains confirmed that he had been strangled to death. In many cases, including Bonin's, the ligature was still around the victim's necks when they were buried. He was the 18th victim to be exhumed from the property and identified through dental records and personal belongings, such as his fishing license, which Gacy had kept. Michael loved carpentry, wrestling, baseball, and was described by his friends as having a great laugh. His sister, Patty, was only 4 years old when he disappeared, but remembers how much the event affected her parents. Her father struggled with severe anxiety and often inquired at the police station about his missing son. He struggled with alcoholism and heavy smoking from the anxiety, often blaming himself. His place of burial is unknown. Rest in peace, Michael Bonin, 1959 to the 3rd of June, 1976, age 17. William Huey Carroll Jr., 13th of June, 1976. 16-year-old William Billy Huey Carroll was from uptown Chicago when he encountered Gacy on Sunday, June 13th, 1976. This was during Gacy's cruising years where he drove around hunting for young boys to offer sex, money, booze, or drugs to. He usually cruised in the evening, so he must have lured William into his car in the evening near Bughouse Square or the Chicago Greyhound bus station, common locations that he frequented to find boys to take home. William's body was found in a common grave and was the 22nd exhumed from the crawl space. He was found with a piece of cloth in his throat and had been buried with body 21, which is yet to be identified. On March 17th, 1979, William was identified through dental records. His remains were buried in Mount Glenwood Memory Gardens West, Cook County, Illinois. Sadly, his brother was killed in an altercation in 1980, and his father died in 1985. They were all buried in the same cemetery. Rest in peace, William Huey Carroll Jr., 31st of August, 1959, to the 13th of June, 1976. Age 16. James Byron Harkinson, 5th of August, 1976. 16-year-old James Byron Jimmy Harkinson entered the kitchen in his Minnesota home in the summer of 1976 and told his parents and three siblings that he was leaving. While he was known as good-natured and funny, he was also remembered as someone who was troubled and often left home to blow off some steam. The last time they saw him, he had just bleached his hair and was off for another adventure, mentioning that he wanted to go to Chicago. His mother, June, was working three jobs at the time, and his father, a plumber, was an alcoholic who was frequently absent. On Thursday, August 5th, 1976, he called his mother to tell her that he was in Chicago and was doing all right. It is believed that he made this call from John Wayne Gacy's house and that he was murdered shortly thereafter. His family never saw or heard from him again, and at one point his mother believed that perhaps her son had integrated into the gay community in Chicago. She filed a missing persons report on September 7th, 1976. The following year, his father died, even though the family had no idea that Jimmy was dead, and was buried in Union Cemetery in Minnesota. His remains were found in the crawl space and known only as Body 24 for 41 years. It was buried beneath Body 23, who turned out to be Rick Johnston, murdered on August the 6th. Perhaps Gacy had another doubles night. He was buried wearing two metal chains, underwear, a shirt, and remnants of his socks, and had a fracture on his right clavicle, collarbone, that had since healed. The cause of death was asphyxiation. While most of his family members had lost hope that they could ever hear from James again, a curious nephew from Texas wanted to confirm or eliminate the possibility that he was one of Gacy's murder victims, and submitted DNA to the Chicago police. It was a match, and on July 19th, 2017, Body 24 was identified as James Harkinson. His mother had died in 2008 and had never received any answers about her missing son. His sister, however, said that it would have killed her, literally. She was buried in St. Mary's Cemetery, New in Minnesota. His siblings are assumed to still be alive, and his sister Lori expressed relief that the family had clarity after so many years of wondering what had happened to him. He was finally laid to rest at the Resurrection Catholic Cemetery and Mausoleum. Rest in peace, James Byron Hawkinson, 10th of June 1960 to the 5th of August 1976, age 16. Rick Louis Johnston, 6th of August 1976. 17-year-old Rick Louis Johnston was last seen alive on Friday, August 6, 1976. He was the son of Kenneth and Esther Johnston and brother of Carl and Greg Johnston from Bensonville, Chicago, Illinois, who still had his whole life ahead of him when he encountered John Wayne Gacy on a summer afternoon in 1976. His remains, at first only known as Body 23, were discovered in a common grave in the crawl space above James Hawkinson's, a pattern which alludes to Gacy likely murdering both boys on the same night, which he called his doubles nights. Both died of asphyxiation and were found semi-dressed when they were buried. Rick was finally identified and laid to rest on March 10, 1979, at the St. Adalbert Catholic Cemetery in Cook County, Illinois, where his mother was also buried in 1993, 14 years later. Rest in peace, Rick Louis Johnston, 25th of September 1958 to the 6th of August 1976, age 17. Kenneth Ray Parker, 24th of October 1976. 16-year-old Kenneth Ray Parker was last seen alive on Sunday, October 24, 1976, when he was on his way to an arcade near Clark Street and Diversey Parkway in Chicago with his friend Michael Marino. Both were never seen or heard from again. Kenneth's body was the 15th exhumed from the crawlspace, where he was buried with his friend and in proximity to another victim, Randall Reffert, and identified through dental records and radiology images. His remains were buried in Rose Hill Cemetery on the north side of Chicago. Rest in peace, Kenneth Ray Parker, 15th of December 1959 to the 24th of October 1976, age 16. Michael Marino, 24th of October 1976. 14-year-old Michael Marino last saw his mother at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on October 24, 1976, when he kissed her on the cheek and headed out to a pinball arcade to meet his friend, Kenneth Parker. The arcade was near Clark Street and Diversey Park, and the pair were last seen alive outside a restaurant in the area, which was one of the locations that Gacy frequented to pick up teenage boys and take home. His remains, body number 14, were found in a common grave shared with his friend Kenneth Ray Parker, body number 15, and identified conclusively through dental records. Edward Pavlik, a forensic orthodontist, analyzed all 32 teeth found with the remains and confirmed that they belonged to Michael Marino. However, his mother, Sherry, never felt that the remains were her son's, particularly because the clothing did not match what she had last seen him wearing a few hours before he disappeared. For more than 30 years, Sherry visited her son's grave with doubt in her mind, saying, "It was just a feeling you get when you're a mother. I'd put my hand on the grave and I'd feel cold. I didn't feel it was Michael in there." In 2012, Sherry had her son's grave exhumed and DNA tested, and the results shockingly came back as a negative match to hers. In 2014, she had Kenneth Parker's grave exhumed to confirm if perhaps they'd mixed up the remains, but it also was not a match. While Kenneth was a confirmed victim, Michael was not, even though the sheriff's office maintains that 13 nationally certified forensic dentists have independently confirmed, conclusively and irrefutably, that Gacy, victim number 14, and Michael Marino are tragically one and the same person. Both bodies were buried at the Queen of Heaven Catholic Cemetery in Hillside, Chicago, and exhumed by 2014 for further testing. While Sherry remains hopeful that her son, who loved Led Zeppelin and dreamed of becoming a professional musician, is alive and somewhere out there, police are certain that Michael Marino was a victim of Gacy's on the same night as his friend, Kenneth Ray Parker. Rest in peace, Michael Marino, 8th of February, 1962, to the 24th of October, 1976, age 14. William George Bundy, 26th of October, 1976. 19-year-old William Billy George Bundy was a Nicholas Senn High School dropout, gymnast, an accomplished diver who had been a construction worker on Chicago's North Side. On Tuesday, October 26, 1976, he called his mother Elizabeth to say that he was going to a party. He was never seen or heard from again, and a missing persons report was filed. When Gacy's crawlspace was exhumed, he was known only as Body 19, and his mother had not come forward to the police for DNA testing because she refused to believe that her son could ever be one of Gacy's victims. After her death in 1990, Williams' siblings approached police to see if any of the unidentified victims matched their DNA. On November 14, 2011, Body 19 was identified as William George Bundy, and the family finally got the closure that they had longed for and deserved. He had died of asphyxiation and was buried in the crawlspace beneath Gacy's master bedroom. His remains were buried at the Resurrection Catholic Cemetery and Mausoleum in Cook County, Illinois. Rest in peace, William George Bundy, 22nd of October, 1957, to the 26th of October, 1976. Age 19. Gregory John Godzik, 12th of December, 1976. 17-year-old Gregory Godzik was last seen on Saturday, December 11, 1976, when he left home to go on a date with his girlfriend, Judy. The pair had broken up and reconciled, so Gregory was immensely excited for his date that night. He had long blonde hair, a slender build, and grey eyes, and as he left, his family teased him for not going to mass with him. After their date, Judy and her mother were the last witnesses to ever see him alive, which was shortly after midnight. Gregory was a hard worker who had been mowing lawns, delivering newspapers, and finding ways to earn money since he was in seventh grade. At the time of his disappearance, he was a senior at Taft High School and planned to go to college the following year. He loved nature and animals, often nursing injured birds and abandoned cats back to health. Gregory had never left the house without giving his mother a kiss on the cheek, and the last time she saw him was no different. For Christmas, he had asked for some new clothes and a special hairbrush, which he sadly never got to unwrap. When his mother noticed that he was not in his room the following morning, she called Judy, his friends, and anyone she could think of that would have last seen her son. A missing persons report was filed, but police told her that he was probably just a runaway, and that they would only be able to start a search after the legal waiting period to do so. A friend spotted Greg's car parked in Niles and saw that it had been left unlocked, something that he never did. His mother knew that something was very wrong, and decided to call his employer, who was none other than John Wayne Gacy. Gregory had only worked for him for 3 weeks before he disappeared, and had come home late one day, telling her that he had to dig trenches for some kind of tiles. Gacy told her that Gregory had not shown up for work on Monday, even though he had called and left a message to say that he would, and that he had probably run away like thousands of teenagers do. When asked if he still had the message from Gregory, Gacy said that he had erased it. He mentioned that he still owed Gregory some money and would pop by her house sometime to give it to her. Of course, he never did. Mrs. Godzik did everything in her power to look for her son, even hiring a private investigator that she could not afford and driving all over Chicago to look for him herself. 2 years later, she heard on the news that John Wayne Gacy had been arrested and that bodies were being exhumed from the crawl space. "That's the man that Gregory worked for," she sobbed. His remains were labeled as Body 4 until dental records conclusively identified him as Gregory Godzik on December 29, 1978. He had been buried right below body number 3, John Syke, tragically in one of the graves that he himself had dug for Gacy. He was buried at the St. Adalbert Catholic Cemetery in Niles, Cook County, Illinois. His mother and father were also buried there when they died, 1989 and 1984. Rest in peace, Gregory John Godzik, 23rd of March 1959 to the 12th of December 1976. Age 17. John Allen Syke, 20th of January 1977. 19-year-old John Allen Syke was living in an apartment on the north side of Chicago and working as a repairman at an engineering firm in Chicago when he disappeared. His parents last saw him on Thursday, January 20th, 1977. When they went to look for clues at his apartment, they found incomplete tax forms on his kitchen table, his bed unmade, and his winter coat laid out. Oddly, while everything appeared to be in order, some items were missing, including his television set, digital clock radio, iron, and hairdryer. At the time, Syke was driving a 1971 Plymouth Satellite, which matched the car that one of Gacy's current employees, Michael Rossi, was driving, and had used to steal gasoline from a gas station in August of 1977. Police records showed that in response to the missing persons report that Syke's parents had filed, they told them that he had sold his car in February of 1977 and told the buyer that he needed the money to leave town. Based on this, the police assumed he was just another runaway. During the surveillance period before Gacy was arrested, they called Michael Rossi in for questioning, who told them that Gacy had shown him the car parked on the side of the road and asked if he wanted to buy it. Rossi knew Syke but was not very fond of him, and when he asked Gacy where he was told that he had left for California and sold the car because he needed the money. They settled on $300 for the car, but Gacy said that he first had to pay off $200 before he would give it to him. He also instructed him to get new number plates, otherwise he would get in trouble. Personal artifacts that police had found in Gacy's house after the first search warrant included a Main West High School class ring with the initials J.A.S. on them. It belonged to John Allen Syke. His body was the third to be exhumed from the crawl space and was buried right above Gregory Godzik's, who had also been employed by Gacy. He was identified through dental records on December 29, 1978. He was buried at St. Adalbert Catholic Cemetery in Niles, Cook County, Illinois, the same cemetery as the boy who was buried with him in the crawl space. Rest in peace, John Allen Syke, 9th of December, 1957, to the 20th of January, 1977. Age 19. John Stephen Prestige, 15th of March, 1977. 20-year-old John Stephen Prestige, originally from Michigan, was visiting friends in Chicago, Illinois, and had told his family that he had secured a job with a local contractor there. He was last seen alive on March 15, 1977. His remains were the first to be exhumed from the crawl space, which confirmed that John Wayne Gacy was a killer. There is no burial information about this victim. Rest in peace, John Stephen Prestige, 3rd of November, 1956, to the 15th of March, 1977. Age, 20. Matthew Bowman, 5th of July, 1977. 19-year-old Matthew Bowman from Crystal Lake, Illinois, was last seen alive by his mother at a suburban train station on Tuesday, July 5th, 1977. His body was the eighth to be exhumed from the crawl space. He had been strangled with a piece of rope or string. He was buried at St. Joseph Cemetery in River Grove, Cook County, Illinois. Rest in peace, Matthew Bowman, 1958 to the 5th of July, 1977. Age, 19. Robert Edward Gilroy, Jr., 15th of September, 1977. 18-year-old Robert Gilroy was last seen alive between 5 and 6 p.m. on Thursday, September 15th, 1977. He was the son of a Chicago police officer, loved horses, and planned to go to college to study agriculture and specialize in animal husbandry. He was the 25th body to be exhumed from Gacy's crawl space, and evidence showed that he had died of asphyxiation and not strangulation. A piece of cloth was lodged in his throat. There is substantial evidence that suggests that Gacy had accomplices and may not have committed all the murders by himself. For example, he was in Pittsburgh on a business trip at the time of Gilroy's disappearance, which might explain the deviation from his usual murder method, which was strangulation with his rope trick. He was buried at Mount Carmel Catholic Cemetery in February 1979 in Cook County, Illinois. Rest in peace, Robert Edward Gilroy, 1961 to the 15th of September, 1977. Age, 18. John Anthony Mowry, 25th of September, 1977. 19-year-old John Mowry was a U.S. Marine who had returned to Chicago after 18 months of service and planned to study accounting. The year before, he had finished high school at Amundsen High School in West Ravenswood, Chicago. On his return, he moved out of his family home and into an apartment with a friend, which his brother remembered being Mike. While it has never been confirmed who this friend was, many have speculated that it was Michael Rossi, who was Gacy's employee and possible accomplice. On Sunday, September 25th, 1977, at approximately 10 p.m., Mowry had told his family that he was going to a party. He was never seen or heard from again. Tragically, his sister, Judith Mowry, had been murdered in her Northside apartment on November the 9th, 1972. Her case remains cold. His body was the 20th to be exhumed from the crawl space, and on January 27th, 1979, he was conclusively identified through dental records. He was likely lured to Gacy's house under the pretense of a job. Evidence revealed that he was strangled to death and buried under Gacy's master bedroom, where William Bundy was buried. Mowry's parents and five siblings described him as a sweet and gentle soul with a bright future ahead of him. There is no burial information about this victim. Many families chose to keep it private to prevent any unwanted attention. Rest in peace, John Anthony Mowry, 13th of March, 1958, to the 25th of September, 1977, age 19. Russell Lloyd Nelson, 17th of October, 1977. 21-year-old Russell Nelson was last seen on Monday, October 17th, 1977, outside a Chicago bar where he was looking for contracting work. He was an architecture student from the University of Minnesota who had traveled to Chicago to visit friends and find work. His father went to Chicago after his disappearance to search for him, but the family would only know 2 years later what had happened to him. A friend, Robert Young, had traveled with Russell to Chicago. Robert, who was from South Dakota, was known as a drifter. When Russell's family asked him to help them search for him, he demanded money, which raised everyone's suspicions. Russell's brothers decided to travel to Chicago to look for him and ran into Robert, who offered them both jobs with PDM. He disappeared after this, possibly returning to South Dakota, but was never investigated even though he was a suspect in Russell's disappearance. Russell's remains were buried in the crawl space below Gacy's guest bedroom and was the 16th to be exhumed. Evidence showed that he died of asphyxiation and had a piece of cloth lodged in his throat. Police admitted that it would not have been likely for Gacy to snatch Russell without his friend Robert noticing, which suggests that he was involved in some way. There is no burial information about this victim. When Gacy was on trial in 1980, Russell's mother was present in court, where she got to see her son's murderer face to face. As long as I live, I'll never forget those eyes staring at me. He looked at me as if he were saying, "So what?" she said. Rest in peace, Russell Lloyd Nelson, 1957 to the 17th of October, 1977. Age 21. Robert Winch, 10th of November, 1977. 16-year-old Robert Winch from Kalamazoo, Michigan, disappeared on Thursday, November 10th, 1977. Kalamazoo is 160 miles, 257 kilometers, from 8213 West Summerdale Avenue, where his remains were found, so he must have been in Chicago at the time. His body was the 11th to be exhumed from the crawl space, and was found lying face down in a grave in the crawl space with a ligature around his neck, and had been buried next to body 12, Tommy Joe Bowling, in the center of the crawl space, directly below the hallway. He was identified by X-ray records from a distinctive bone fracture that had healed. He also had a belt buckle with a tiger's eye and a black stripe, which was found buried next to the body. There is no burial information about this victim. Rest in peace, Robert Winch, 1961 to the 10th of November, 1977. Age 16. Tommy Joe Bowling, 18th of November, 1977. 20-year-old Tommy Joe Bowling, originally from Maryville, Blount County, Tennessee, had moved to Chicago with his parents when he was a kid. His grandmother said that he would visit his extended family in Tennessee frequently during the holidays. Bowling was married and a father of one son named Timmy when he disappeared. He was last seen alive outside of a bar in Chicago on Friday, November 18, 1977. In December 1978, his remains were the 12th to be exhumed from the crawl space at Gacy's house. He was buried face down in the center of the crawl space, directly below the hallway, and still had a ligature around his neck. Robert Winch, body 11, was buried directly beside him and in the same way. His final resting place was at the Aljoy Baptist Church Cemetery in Aljoy, Blount County, Tennessee. Rest in peace, Tommy Joe Bowling, 5th of June, 1957, to the 18th of November, 1977, age 20. David Paul Telsma, 9th of December, 1977. 19-year-old Chicago and U.S. Marine David Telsma disappeared on Friday, December 9th, 1977, after telling his mother that he was attending a rock concert in Hammond, Indiana that evening. The UFO Lights Out concert was being held at the Hammond Civic Center, where the band lineup included UFO, Cheap Trick, and the Rockets. It is 48 miles, 77 kilometers, south of Gacy's house, which means that he likely picked him up before his journey even began, either while hitchhiking or at the Chicago Greyhound bus station. He was the 17th victim to be exhumed from the crawlspace and had been buried with a ligature around his neck. On November 16, 1979, what would have been his 21st birthday, he was identified through x-rays, which showed a distinct fracture on his left shoulder blade, the scapula, that had healed. There is no burial information about this victim. Rest in peace, David Paul Talsma, 16th of November, 1958, to the 9th of December, 1977. Age 19. William Wayne Kindred, 16th of February, 1978. 19-year-old William Kindred disappeared on February 16, 1978. His last known location was a bar in Chicago. He told his wife that he would be spending the evening there. Gacy loved bar hopping and partying, so he either encountered him at the bar or on a cruise, perhaps when Kindred was on his way home. He was the 27th and final victim that had been buried in the crawlspace. On May 21, 1979, he was identified through dental records. He was buried at Little Memory Church Cemetery in Sunman, Ripley County, Indiana. Rest in peace, William Wayne Kindred, 14th of July, 1958, to the 16th of February, 1978. Age 19. Timothy D. O'Rourke, 16th to the 23rd of June, 1978. 20-year-old Timothy O'Rourke left his apartment on Dover Street, Chicago, shortly after midnight to buy some cigarettes. He was never seen alive again. Timothy was the first victim that Gacy had dropped into the Des Plaines River from Smith's Bridge along the Interstate 55, the I-55. His body was found 6 miles, 9.6 kilometers downstream on June 30th, 1979, by a barge crewman. He had a Tim Lee tattoo on his upper left arm, and while the body was badly decomposed, police were able to lift his fingerprints. After publishing an article in the Chicago Sun-Times about the body found in the river, useful leads came in, where it was revealed that Tim Lee frequented gay bars in Chicago and whose real name was Timothy O'Rourke. Police were able to track down his father, who confirmed that his son had a Tim Lee tattoo on his upper left arm, which helped to identify him through dental records, x-rays, and fingerprints. He was the 31st victim linked to Gacy, and a phone call from a transsexual who knew him told the police that he had mentioned being offered a job with PDM, but that he thought the boss was giving him the runaround. When the friend had asked if his potential boss was homosexual, Tim just nodded and smiled. He was buried at Braceville Gardner Cemetery in Braceville, Grundy County, Illinois. His memorial stone reads, "If among angels in heaven we could glance, we'd see Tim with a smile doing his disco dance." Rest in peace, Timothy D. O'Rourke, 1957 to June 1978. Age 20. Frank William Landingen, 4th of November 1978. 19-year-old Frank Landingen was last seen alive on Saturday, November 4th, 1978. In the year before his disappearance, he had been arrested several times for auto theft and battery, and was known to be involved in gang-related criminal activity. He was a street hustler, drug dealer, and pimp who operated on the north side of Chicago. His naked body was found floating in the Des Plaines River on November 12, 1978, and was the second body that Gacy had discarded of this way because his crawl space was full, and was the 32nd body retrieved in the investigation. Landingen was found with his underpants lodged in his throat, and evidence showed that he had choked on his own vomit when he died. The cause of death was asphyxiation, not strangulation, just like 12 other boys. Police were able to confirm that he had a large meal about an hour and a half before his death, likely with his friends who last saw him, and that he had ejaculated before he died. They suspected that he had Chinese stir-fry for dinner and confirmed that his seminal vesicles were empty when he died. So, as always, Gacy had used someone for sexual gratification and threw them out like trash when he'd had his fun. He was buried at Maryhill Catholic Cemetery and Mausoleum in Niles, Cook County, Illinois, on November 21st, 1978. Rest in peace, Frank William Landingen, 5th of July, 1959, to the 4th of November, 1978. Age 19. James Mazzara, 24th of November, 1978. 20-year-old James Mazzara from Elmwood Park, Chicago, told his family on Thanksgiving, Thursday, November 23rd, that he got a job in construction that paid him well. He was last seen alive with a suitcase in his hand walking towards Bughouse Square, one of Gacy's favorite pickup spots. In the year before his disappearance, he had been arrested for damaging property and being in possession of marijuana. His friends nicknamed him Mojo and knew him as a bubbly Italian guy. When he did not return home for Christmas, his family were concerned but decided not to file a missing persons report. On December 28, 1978, his naked body was seen floating downstream of the I-55 bridge just before sunset, where it was retrieved and taken to a funeral home for further examination. 2 days later, he was identified by fingerprints. His previous arrests helped to match his fingerprints on the police database without delay. When Gacy had been arrested, he told police that his second last victim was Something Joe from Elmwood Park. Mojo. He said that they had met shortly after Thanksgiving and that Mazzara had consented to sex in exchange for money. He broke two of Gacy's rules, which is why he ended up being strangled. First, he dominated him in the bedroom, and second, he tried to increase the price that they had agreed on to offer additional sexual favors. Gacy did not have any tolerance for this and murdered him using his standard rope trick, not even needing to use handcuffs, and dumped his body in the river the following night. Mazzara was the 33rd and final body to be found in the case. He was buried at the Queen of Heaven Catholic Cemetery in Hillside, Cook County, Illinois. Rest in peace, James Mazzara, 1958 to the 24th of November, 1978. Age 20. Robert Jerome Piest, 11th of December, 1978. 15-year-old Robert Jerome Piest, a Main West high school student, worked part-time at Nissen's Pharmacy so that he could save up to buy a car. He wanted to buy a Jeep and loved the outdoors and had been saving up for a few months when he encountered John Wayne Gacy on December 11, 1978. Gacy was well acquainted with the owner, Phil Torf, and had been hired for a remodeling job to boost the business. Piest was quietly stocking the shelves in the back when Gacy spotted him and bragged about how much he paid the teenagers who worked for him, hoping it would pique his interest. After some time in the store, Gacy headed home and remembered along the way that he had forgotten his appointment book on the counter. Can there be any doubt that he did this on purpose? He re-entered the store and made small talk with Torf as he watched Piest's every move. He knew that they were closing at 9 p.m. and had timed his exit perfectly. Piest's mother had arrived to pick up her son and was waiting in the pharmacy when he ran outside to take out the trash and talk to a contractor about a job. He was never seen alive again. It was her 46th birthday, and the family had looked forward to cutting a cake and celebrating a joyful occasion together. Gacy later admitted that Rob was not his usual target, and that if he had not picked him up that night, he may have never been caught for his crimes. Piest's family called the police non-stop until something was done about his disappearance, while sleeplessly searching for him throughout the neighborhood and asking as many people as possible for information. At one point, they even got hold of Gacy himself, who told them that he did not remember even seeing their son. It was because of this case that Gacy was put under 24-hour surveillance until a second search warrant gave police access to his crawl space. According to Gacy's confessions, Piest got into his car under the pretense of discussing how he could earn some extra cash, which in Gacy's words meant $20 to perform oral sex on him. He drove the boy to his house, telling him that he would take him home after a discussion about a potential job and what it would take to work for him. Once they were there, he handcuffed him and tried to perform oral sex on him, saying, "I'm going to rape you and there's nothing you can do about it." But Piest was unable to get an erection and cried during the ordeal. Gacy offered to drive him home, but right before they left at approximately 10 p.m., Rob held the doorknob and said, "Gee, I thought you were going to kill me." That was the moment that Gacy knew that there was a risk that he would tell his parents, the police, or neighbors about the incident, and decided that he would have to kill him. He asked him if he could show him just one more trick before they left, and put the rope around his neck to perform his standard rope trick. As Rob struggled for life on the floor and convulsed in agony, Gacy answered a business call. The person who made the call said that he had not sounded any different that night and had his usual business discussions, which is frightening to think about. When Robert died, Gacy stripped him naked and carried his body to his bed, where he slept next to him for the night. The next day, he carried him to the attic, which is where his body was when police first came to his house to question Gacy about the boy's disappearance. To think that he was able to be so calm and cheerful with police, while the body of the boy they were questioning him about was hovering over them in the attic, is shocking. Gacy was clearly a well-trained actor and liar. That evening, he wrapped him in a blanket, placed him in the trunk of his car, and drove to Smith's Bridge on the I-55, where he threw his body into the Des Plaines River. On April 9, 1979, a man on a tug spotted a naked body floating face down in the river, approximately 6 miles downstream from the bridge. The body, body number 30, was taken to Lennox Funeral Home, where x-rays and dental records confirmed that the remains were Rob Piest's. His cause of death was asphyxiation, based on the wads of paper found lodged in his throat, evidently while he was still alive and struggling with a rope around his neck. He was buried at the All Saints Catholic Cemetery and Mausoleum in Des Plaines, Cook County, Illinois, on April 18, 1979. His funeral was attended by a large gathering of Des Plaines police officers, school classmates, friends, and his family, and was truly a tragic end to his inspiring life. Rob had a zest for life and loved animals, gymnastics, outdoor adventures, and his family. Rest in peace, Rob Piest, 16th of March, 1963, to the 11th of December, 1978. Age 15. Unidentified victims. Body 28, January 1972. Male, age 14 to 18. Gacy told detectives that his second murder occurred in approximately January of 1974, 2 years after his first. He used his rope trick on him, which caused his victim to die of strangulation, and stored his body in the closet overnight. The corpse leaked bodily fluids from the nose and mouth, allegedly stored upside down, which is why Gacy started stuffing cloth, paper, or underwear in his victims' throats, and often put bags around their heads and torsos. This victim was buried in the crawl space and was the 28th body to be exhumed, where it was found on March 9, 1979, buried near Gacy's barbecue pit in the backyard. He wore a silver ring on the fourth finger of his left hand, and it was the first time the police had realized that some victims may have been engaged or married. He was approximately 5'9", 180 centimeters in height, likely had brown hair, and was estimated to be between 14 and 18 years old. Autopsy results showed that he died between January 3, 1972 and July 31, 1975. A facial reconstruction was released to the media in 2018, but he remains unidentified. Body 26, 13th of June to the 5th of August 1976, male, age 23 to 30. Between June 13th and August 5th, 1976, following his divorce from his second wife, Carol, Gacy murdered this victim and buried him in the crawl space. He is estimated to have been between age 23 and 30, had medium brown hair, and was 5'4" in height, 160 centimeters. He also had two missing upper front teeth, with police speculating that this victim wore a denture. A facial reconstruction was released to the media in 2018, but this victim remains unidentified. Body 13, 6th of August to the 5th of October 1976, male, age 17 to 22. Between August the 6th and October the 5th, 1976, Gacy murdered this victim and buried him in the crawl space. During this time, he had also murdered Rick Louis Johnston, August 6, 1976. He was between 5'9", 180 centimeters, and 6'2", 190 centimeters in height, had long dark brown wavy hair, and was between 17 and 22 years old. His left third rib was injured either months or years before he died, and evidence showed that he had an abscess tooth. He was buried naked in the northeast corner of the crawl space in proximity to Russell Nelson, body 16, and Michael Bonin, body 18. In interviews, David Cram remembered digging this specific grave for a drain tile for Gacy. A facial reconstruction was released to the media in 2018, but this victim remains unidentified. Body 21. 6th of August to the 24th of October 1976, male, age 15 to 24. Between August 6th and October 24th, 1976, Gacy murdered this victim and buried him right above William Carroll, body 22, murdered June 13th, 1976. He was 5'10", 180 centimeters in height, had light brown hair, and was between 15 and 24 years old. Police have estimated that this murder took place between August 6th and 20th, when David Cram had not moved into his house yet. He was buried naked, but due to decomposition, little is known about how he died. During this time, Gacy murdered James Harkinson, body 24, 5th of August 1976. Rick Louis Johnston, body 23, 6th of August 1976. Kenneth Ray Parker, body 15, 24th of October 1976. And Michael Marino, body 14th, 24th of October 1976. A facial reconstruction was released to the media in 2018, but this victim remains unidentified. Body 5. November 1976 to the 15th of March 1977, male, age 22 to 32. Between November 1976 and March 15, 1977, this victim was murdered and buried in the crawl space. His remains were found with a leather accessory on his keychain, which was inscribed with the name Greg on it. Police speculate that his name was Greg or Gregory. He was between 22 and 32 years old, was 5'9", 180 centimeters in height, and had a broken nose at some point in his life before he was murdered. He was buried in the northeastern corner of the crawl space. John Prestige, body 1, 15th of March 1977, was buried right above him. Gregory Godsick, body number 4, 12th of December 1976, who dug this victim's grave and his own, was buried in proximity, along with John Syke, body number 3, 20th of January 1977. A facial reconstruction was released to the media in 2018, but this victim remains unidentified. Body 10, 15th of March to the 5th of July 1977. Male, age 17 to 21. While factors have led police to speculate that this victim was murdered as early as 1974, it is generally believed that he died between March 15th and July 5th, 1977. He was between 17 and 21 years old, 5'7", 170 centimeters, to 5'11", 180 centimeters in height, had brown hair, and had a fracture in his left collarbone, the clavicle, that had healed. He was buried wearing jockey-type underpants and reddish-colored socks. Gacy had murdered John Stephen Prestige, body 1, 15th of March 1977, and Matthew Bowman, body 8, 5th of July 1977, during this time frame. A facial reconstruction was released to the media in 2018, but this victim remains unidentified. Interesting facts about the remains. Based on all the evidence that was recovered from the crawl space, the other parts of the property, and the bodies found in the Des Plaines River, here is a summary of what was found. There were 33 victims recovered in total, of which 31 were murdered between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m. 13 died of asphyxiation. 1 died of stab wounds, and the rest died from strangulation, likely from Gacy's rope trick. 23 bodies were identified with dental records, 2 from skeletal trauma, and the rest from personal artifacts and Gacy's confessions. 6 bodies still remain unidentified. 53 teeth in total were missing from the remains in the crawl space. 2 victims were U.S. Marines John Mowry and David Telsma. 3 victims had broken collarbones or shoulder blades, Robert Winch, David Telsma, and Body 10. And 2 were married, William Kindred and Body 28. Gacy buried 2 victims under his master bedroom, William Bundy and John Mowry, 1 under his dining room, Daryl Julius Sampson, 1 under his guest bedroom, Russell Lloyd Nelson, and 1 in the garage covered in concrete, John Butkovich. Some victims appear to have been buried alive, even though this was not conclusively confirmed. Most still had a ligature around their necks, some were naked, some wore shoes and underwear, and many had cloth, paper, or their own underwear stuffed down their throat. One victim's remains that had been identified via dental records remains a mystery because his DNA did not match his mother's, Michael Marino. Sherry Marino has not given up on the case and hopes to find out what happened to her son one day. Surviving victims. According to Gacy, he had approximately 1,500 sexual partners in his life, which he said made it challenging to remember names and details of even those who are supposedly his victims. There are many victims who survived the worst of Gacy, even though the memory of him raping, torturing, and humiliating them has had a lasting effect. While some victims have spoken to the police about their ordeal, many have either chosen not to come forward or have chosen to remain anonymous. Gacy was able to put fear into young boys' hearts and consume their minds even while he was on death row, as detailed in Jason Moss's book, The Last Victim. Some of his employees, including Michael Rossi and David Cram, had frequent altercations with him and had to fight off his persistent sexual advances. For example, Cram said that while him and Gacy were on good terms, he always had to sleep in pants to avoid being found in a vulnerable position in the middle of the night while he lived with him. Gacy entered his room in the middle of the night and threatened to rape him, telling him that he knew what he wanted and that by now he should know who he is dealing with. One consequence of Gacy's promiscuous lifestyle was that he was found to be syphilitic when he was arrested in 1978. Let's discover the details of some of the accounts that were given by survivors of the killer clown. Michael Reed, 1971. Michael Reed was a 20-year-old who had just arrived in Chicago in November 1970 when he encountered Gacy while he was cruising on Clark Street, propositioning him to get into his car. He drove Reed to his mother's apartment, where he performed fellatio on him and masturbated, completing the evening by offering him a job. He accepted, and the pair started working on building the foundation of PDM contractors, which meant doing work for the clients that Gacy had met while he worked at Bruno's restaurant. When Gacy had persuaded his mother to help him purchase the Norwich house on West Summerdale Avenue, he asked Reed to move in with him. According to Reed, they shared one bedroom while Gacy's mother stayed in the other bedroom. So Gacy was comfortable sharing a bed with a boy, but avoided the bedroom at all costs when he was married to Carol Hoff. When he was married, he chose to sleep on the couch in the living room, even once his mother and mother-in-law had moved out, who each had a turn to occupy one bedroom. Reed told police that Gacy had frequently bragged about playing policeman, where he said that he had handcuffed, beaten, tortured, and raped young men. He thought that it was just another one of Gacy's elaborate, exaggerated stories. To his horror, he found out later that it was all true and worse. One day, after a long day of work, Gacy had asked Reed to bend down to get a spare fuse under a workbench. When he bent down to look for it, he struck him on the back of the head with a hammer, which caused significant pain, but did not knock him out, as Gacy may have hoped. He asked him why he had hit him, and was told that it was just a sudden, overwhelming urge to kill him. Reed moved out the following day, even though he continued to work for Gacy for some time after the incident. Jack Peisler. Jack Peisler was a PDM employee who had accompanied his boss on a business trip to Florida. Gacy raped him in his hotel room while on the trip, which he never reported to the police. Instead, he opted to attack his attacker himself, which got him a battery charge and a 1-year probation sentence. Patrick Datey, January 1972. In his 2014 book, I Am Me, Survivor of Child Abuse and Bullying Speaks Out, Patrick Datey details the experience he had with Gacy when he was just 9 years old. Datey's mother had always warned him not to go to a public restroom without his father or brother, but on this occasion, he went in by himself in a department store on Belmont and Central. When he saw Gacy's photograph on the news after he was caught as a serial killer, Datey vomited and knew that it was the same man who had assaulted him. According to his account, Gacy had cornered him in the men's room and threatened him with a knife as he raped him, telling him that if he told anyone, he would track him down and kill him. While the police have acknowledged that Datey does not fit Gacy's usual victim profile, it's not impossible, based on his predatory behavior and sexual desires for young, vulnerable boys and men. Tom Dart, a Cook County sheriff who worked on the case, said, "Not all of his victims were killed. There were plenty of his victims that got away, thankfully. Some of those came forward back then and gave a lot of the details. Some of them didn't know who this guy was." Datey expressed that he felt such tremendous guilt and shame after the incident that he ideated suicide for most of his life, which got worse when he learned what Gacy had done. "I started to feel the guilt that because I didn't come forward that I may have been able to save so many other kids' lives and I didn't," he said. Arthur Vinsel, Autumn 1977. Information from The Killer Clown by Terry Sullivan and Peter Macon. Arthur Vinsel, his name was changed to protect his identity, had dated and lived with John Syke, one of Gacy's identified victims found in the crawl space, for several months before his disappearance. He had moved to California to escape the cold winters in Chicago and was shocked to hear that his former lover and friend had gone missing. In the early hours of the morning in autumn of 1977, he was leaving a popular gay bar on Chicago's north side when he noticed a black car with two bright spotlights closing in on him. The car stopped and Gacy rolled down his window, asking him if he wanted to smoke some marijuana together. He accepted, got in the car, and sat silently as they drove to Gacy's house, where he was ushered into the bar area. He rolled a few joints and gave it to him, also offering him Valium and a range of other substances to try while he interviewed him about his views on S&M. When the young man played dumb, Gacy got up to fetch his detective badge and handcuffs from the room, telling him that he worked in the narcotics division downtown. He asked if he had ever been handcuffed, and when he answered no and explained that he had no interest in trying it, Gacy directed him to the bedroom, where he cuffed his hands behind his back, shackled his ankles, and said that it was the only way that he could get off. "If you don't obey your master, there's only one recourse. Death," he said, while rubbing his penis all over the man's chest and stomach. Vinsel asked to use the bathroom, where he managed to get his handcuffed hands under his legs to the front. When Gacy saw this, he insisted that he was not going to hurt him and got him to agree to being recuffed the way that he was before. Back in the bedroom, Gacy tied a rope around his neck and started performing the rope trick as he got aroused. Realizing that his life was in danger, the man slid his body in a way that got his hands in reach of Gacy's testicles. He grabbed his thigh and testicles and squeezed as hard as he could, which stopped him in his tracks and made him whimper in pain. Gacy was upset about the pain that the man had caused him, complaining about it as he got dressed. He fetched a gun from the other room and said, "I wasn't going to hurt you. If I was going to kill you, I would have used this." Amazingly, Gacy drove him back to the city and dropped him off outside a hotel. While this victim showed his friends his injuries and had complained to a barman in a nearby gay club, he did not ever report the incident, wholeheartedly believing that he would be snitching on a cop. He had heard through the grapevine that the sadistic man with a black car was a real cop, so he rather stayed quiet about it. Robert Danelli, 30th of December, 1977. On Friday, December 30th, 1977, 19-year-old Robert Danelli was walking to a bus stop after having some beers at a friend's house when he saw a black car with its spotlights focused on him moving closer. Gacy asked Danelli for identification, pretending to be a stern police officer. When he casually got his ID card out, Gacy instructed him to get in the car, otherwise he would blow him away, showing him his gun. Danelli noticed that Gacy was wearing a black patrol-type jacket, dark blue pants, black shoes, which certainly looked like a police officer. He also saw PDM painted on the side of the vehicle, which he assumed must have been police department. He followed Gacy's instructions and was told to shut up any time that he asked questions. He drove him to his house, escorted the cuffed man into his living room, pushed him onto the couch, and left the room for a moment to change his clothing. When he returned, he was wearing jeans and an unbuttoned shirt, but still had the demeanor. "I'm 35 years old. People don't respect me," he said, downing three drinks before he offered Danelli one. When Danelli politely declined, Gacy was furious, telling him that he was an ungrateful little bastard. He also said, "Girls are ungrateful to me, even though I have money. They're just hung up on looks and that's all." This provides some insight into Gacy's success at dating or having sex with women. It seemed to be a point of frustration for him. Gacy threatened Danelli with a gun and told him that the house was soundproof. He asked for his wallet, which he scratched through, interrogating him about his place of work, family, and information about himself. Then he instructed him to put the handcuffs on himself. When Danelli declined, Gacy attacked him, pulled him by his hair, ripped his pants off, and raped him, which made him pass out. When he regained consciousness, Gacy said, "If you fight me now, I'll kill you," before he dragged him to the bathroom, where a pre-filled bathtub of water waited for them. He slammed his head into the wall, tied a rope around his neck, tripped him, and pushed his head underwater as he held onto the rope. Danelli passed out, and when he woke up, Gacy was glaring at him from the toilet, saying, "Looking for me?" and then urinated on him. After several more head-dunking minutes, Gacy dragged him back to the bedroom, where he put on pornography and mumbled to himself about what fun they could have next. Naturally, he came up with something even more terrifying: Russian roulette. As the gun clicked and rolled, Gacy said that he had murdered some girls in Schiller Park before, but said that girls are no fun to kill. Guys are more interesting to kill. He choked him until he passed out, then raped him with a sex toy as he slipped in and out of consciousness. Eventually, Danelli screamed, "Why didn't you just kill me and get it over with?" To which he replied that he was getting round to it. At some stage, after more torture, fondling, and rape, Gacy walked Danelli back to the bathroom and told him to have a shower and get dressed while he watched. He walked him back into his car, saying, "I'm going to kill you. How does it feel knowing you're going to die?" He had memorized Danelli's workplace address and drove him to the entrance, telling him that if he reported him, he would hunt him down and kill him. He also said that the police would never believe him, which sadly was the case. Danelli reported the incident to the police on December 31, 1977, telling them that Gacy had bragged about killing people and threatened to kill him. When police arrested Gacy on January 6, 1978, and questioned him about the incident, all charges were dropped. They believed Gacy's version of the events, where he said that it had been nothing more than consensual sex slave fun. The only justice that Danelli was given was receiving a $3,000 settlement to cover at least half of the medical costs that he needed to recover. In 1980, the 21-year-old Danelli was invited to testify at Gacy's trial in court. His shocking story stuck with the jury, even though Gacy smirked and shook his head throughout his testimony, feigning disbelief with each unfolding detail. Reliving the trauma caused Danelli to stutter, sweat, and eventually break down. When he was shown a photograph of Gacy's couch and recreation room, he begged for mercy, and when Gacy's defense attorneys grilled him about being raped, he fought back, but suffered incredible psychological strain. His father and grandfather passed away, and Danelli was hospitalized for stress, but was eventually able to get his life back together. He received a state scholarship and a federal grant for his college education. Jeffrey Rignall, 21st of March, 1978. Jeffrey Rignall was a 27-year-old student from Winter Park, Florida, when he encountered John Wayne Gacy. He was bisexual and living with his girlfriend and a male companion at the time, and was walking to a local gay bar in Rosemont, Illinois on March 21, 1978. Gacy was on a cruise in his black Oldsmobile, which was fitted with spotlights and could make some of his victims believe that he was a police officer. On this night, he spotted Rignall, rolled down the window, and offered him a joint and a ride. Once he was in the car, Gacy drove for a short while before pushing a chloroform-drenched rag over his face, which knocked him out. He woke up intermittently on the 20-minute drive, but Gacy kept giving him more chloroform. When they got to his house, Gacy dragged him into his bedroom and tortured him until approximately 4 a.m. Then he dragged him back into the car and dropped his unconscious body at Lincoln Park on Chicago's waterfront, where he eventually woke up in shock. Rignall remembered that when he had regained consciousness in Gacy's house, he had been tied to a 2x4 torture rack, a device inspired by Elmer Wayne Henley that Gacy had copycatted, where he was repeatedly raped and abused with a variety of sex toys. He was whipped, drugged, and raped by the flabby, naked, and sadistic Gacy, who told him each time what he was going to do to him. At one point, Rignall remembered seeing another man kneeling on the floor, watching his abuse, and at another time, he remembered seeing a light turn on in another part of the house. This contributed to the speculation that Gacy had accomplices, even though some have said that Rignall may have been hallucinating from being drugged. Rignall woke up with chloroform burns on his face and was bleeding from being raped. He managed to get up and stumble back to his girlfriend's house, beaten and bruised and in a terrible state. She immediately took him to Northwestern Memorial Hospital, where he stayed for 6 days as he recovered. Police visited him in hospital and listened to his account of events, but tragically, it was not investigated at the time. Rignall rented a car when he was out of hospital and staked out the area where he was picked up until he spotted Gacy's car again. 3 days later, he was able to write down the license plate number and offer it to the police. While the case was filed, it was not prioritized and was still pending when Gacy was arrested for serial murder by the end of the year. Rignall partnered with author Ron Wilder to write a book titled 29 Below, which detailed his ordeal and got him invited to the trial. He testified saying that Gacy attacked him in a beastly and animalistic way and was, in his opinion, not sane at the time of the crime. Because his attacker was sitting in court, Rignall experienced severe PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, where he vomited and wept as he told his story before being assisted out of court. He suffered permanent liver damage from the excessive chloroform and died on December 24, 2000, from AIDS-related health complications. His only consolation was knowing that his attacker was executed, which was a celebrated occasion for many. Anthony Antonucci, 1975. Gacy hired 16-year-old Anthony Tony Antonucci in 1975, which his parents approved of because they had met Gacy at church. Shortly after he started working for the contractor, he was driven to the Democratic headquarters, where he was given some whiskey and propositioned for oral sex. Antonucci assumed that his boss was just pulling his socks and laughed it off, which Gacy did not respond well to. He wrestled with the boy and only backed off when Antonucci had gotten hold of a chair and started swinging it at him. He offered to drive him to his house, saying that he wanted him to get some rest for an early morning job. When they got there, he let him sleep on the couch and did not harass him further. That is until 1 month later, when Antonucci's parents had asked Gacy to check on their son because they were going out of town for a few days. He arrived at the boy's apartment with a bottle of wine, a projector screen, and some pornographic films, saying that he had been in the neighborhood attending a party. As soon as Gacy had set foot in the apartment, he started wrestling with him again, this time slamming handcuffs on his wrists before pulling his pants down. He momentarily stopped and headed toward the kitchen, not realizing that Antonucci's one hand had not been properly secured. The boy was on the high school wrestling team, which gave him an advantage in the situation. He waited for him to return, tackled him, found the key, slammed the one handcuff onto Gacy's wrist, freed his other hand, and locked it onto him. "You're the only one who ever got out of these and got them on me." He was impressed. Antonucci released him after approximately 10 minutes and let him out. The dragon had been slayed, at least for him. Jason Moss, 1994. In August 1993, Jason Moss, an 18-year-old college student, visited a bookstore and came across The Killer Clown by Terry Sullivan and Peter Macon. After reading about John Wayne Gacy, he decided to write a research paper on him for school and wrote to him on death row. When Gacy replied, a series of letters followed for several months, which evolved into Sunday morning collect calls from Menard Correctional Facility. Jason took the approach of portraying himself in a way that would appeal to his depravity, the same strategy he used to contact Richard Ramirez, Jeffrey Dahmer, and Charles Manson. Eventually, Gacy invited him to visit him in person, which 18-year-old Jason could not resist. It was too exciting and thrilling to miss. Gacy paid for his flight and motel stay and got a relative to chauffeur him to and from the prison. While the interaction was expected to be safe and secure, of course, Gacy had connections in prison, which meant that Jason was left alone with him in a room for long enough to see his most evil side. He described him as a Jekyll and Hyde personality, where he would switch between being a down-to-earth, friendly, and considerate guy to suddenly being an aggressive sexual predator threatening to rape him and stab him in the neck with a pen. The book that Jason Moss authored following his experiences with serial killers was titled The Last Victim, and it offers insight into what Gacy's victims might have gone through when he attacked them. Even though Jason was much taller and stronger than him, he said that Gacy made him feel small and powerless, where he was not sure if he would make it out of the prison visit alive. Gacy's abuse and behavior affected so many lives. It also affected Jason's. He sadly ended his own life in 2006, suffering with depression and mental illness, living up to the name of his own book. The letters that Moss shared with Gacy are discussed in detail in his book. I have also discussed them exclusively here. Patreon.com/grizzly_books. Suspected victims found alive. Some missing persons cases in Illinois fit the profile for Gacy's victims perfectly, and it is suspected that some may be the unidentified ones. Without DNA evidence from families, it's impossible to confirm. In 2011, 35 years after his death, Body 19 was identified as William George Bundy, and in 2017, 41 years after his death, Body 24 was identified as James Harkinson through DNA matches, which still left 6 unidentified victims found in Gacy's crawl space. A list of who they could be was made, and over time, that list got shorter when some missing people were found alive and well and living in other states. Harold Wayne Lovell left his home at the age of 19 in 1977 and told his family that he was going to work in construction. When news of the Gacy case broke, his family feared the worst. However, his siblings never stopped looking for him. With the help of an internet search in 2011, they found a photograph of their brother who had been arrested for possession of marijuana in 2006, and were able to track him down and contact him telephonically. "I never felt wanted at home, so I left," he said. He took a bus home and reunited with his brother, Tim, and sister, Teresa, after 34 years. What was shocking was that he had met Gacy before he left. "I did some yard work for him. A few times he actually tried to get me into the house, but I wouldn't go, and thank God that I didn't." His mother, who passed away before Lovell was located, had recognized some of his personal belongings in the crime scene photos. Lovell confirmed that the items were his, but had no idea why Gacy had them in his possession. Robert Hutton was reported missing in 1972 when he was 21 years old, and his family had feared that he was one of Gacy's victims. He told his family that he was traveling from New York to California, and since then, his family had not seen or heard from him again. Police closed his missing persons case after several years of failed attempts to locate him. When families were asked to come forward to help identify the victims who had no name yet, Hutton's family reignited their case. He was found alive in Colorado, telling police that he had attempted to contact his family in the 80s and 90s, but struggled to get hold of them. He said he just got caught up in the 70s lifestyle, and after years went by, he became embarrassed that he hadn't had contact with his family, and that it made it easier to just dismiss them, the police said. Hutton was reunited with his father first, who was in his 80s and in poor health, and then reunited with his siblings. Three other missing men that were suspected of being Gacy's victims were found, two of which died of natural causes. Possible additional victims. Gacy told the police that he may have murdered as many as 45 boys, and that he threw 5 bodies into the Des Plaines River. Only 4 bodies were ever found in the river, which means that he could have at least one more victim that was never found, and many others that were never linked to him. Terry Sullivan, the author of The Killer Clown, and who was a prosecuting attorney at Gacy's trial, said, "There's no reason to believe that Gacy didn't kill 100 people. We knew there were 33, but in my mind, I'm pretty certain he had other victims." On one of Gacy's death row paintings, depicting a farmhouse in Arkansas, he wrote, "Find the bodies if you can," a message intended to taunt the police. His mother had moved to Arkansas to live with her daughter in 1975, and he used to visit them in the summer months. He also traveled extensively for business over the years, so many believe that his victims could span across several states and were not confined to his house in Norwich. On May 25, 1978, the body of PDM employee Charles Hatula was found drowned in the Pecatonica River near Freeport, Illinois, 101 miles or 162 kilometers from Gacy's house. He had been reported missing since May 13th, and when police interviewed Michael Rossi, another PDM employee, about it, he said that Gacy told several employees that Hatula had drowned. According to Freeport police, Hatula fell from the bridge into the waters below and died of asphyxiation. However, this could well have been Gacy's first victim thrown into a river once his crawl space was full. Just 2 months later, he threw Timothy D. O'Rourke in the Des Plaines River, 40 miles closer to his house than the Pecatonica River. Gacy was the maintenance manager of an apartment block at 6114 West Miami Avenue from 1971 until at least 1975, which was only 4 miles from his house. At some point between 1972 and 1975, he moved his mother into this 5-unit apartment block, so to him, it may have felt like his second home. Several residents who lived there at the time were eyewitnesses of Gacy's odd nighttime activities, which included digging trenches in the yard, blacking out the windows of the laundry and storage rooms, pouring concrete and dragging heavy bags across the grounds. If he was ever questioned, he shrugged it all off as contracting work and showed them what he had planted, painted, and fixed. One of these witnesses was Bill Dorsch, a former homicide detective with the Chicago Police Department, who lived a few doors down from this apartment block. One night in 1975, he spotted Gacy near the property with a shovel in his hand at 3 a.m. When he noticed Dorsch, he said, "Bill, you know me, not enough hours in the day, you get it done when you can." But what Gacy was getting done is still a mystery. When Dorsch retired in 1994 after 24 years of service, he was asked which cases in his career had frustrated him the most, and one of them was Gacy's. In his mind, he was certain that Gacy had buried some of his victims on this property, but at the time, there was little that he could do about it. Police had their hands full with the excavation of the property on West Summerdale Avenue, something which they had never expected to uncover in the first place. Dorsch was well-connected and had become a private investigator once he had retired from the police department. After casual conversations with some colleagues, a group decided that it would be worth pursuing the search of this property further. In October 1998, a company called La Barca was on the scene to scan the grounds using their infrared technology, which showed as many as 20 suspect spots containing buried material and anomalies. The police took the lead on digging on the property, but told Dorsch that he was not permitted to attend the dig, nor were the media allowed close to the property at the time. A superficial dig was carried out, and to no one's surprise, no bodies were found. Ron LaBarca commented that his infrared findings revealed some pretty compelling evidence that would send any investigation team to the hardware store for shovels. However, to this day, what the grounds of the property hold remains a mystery. A second search was conducted in 2013, which also did not report finding any human remains. In an interview, Dorsch said, "This is a reputation ruiner. No one wants to go back to what happened in 1978. No one wants to revisit that. No one wants to admit that they stopped an investigation before it was finished." Robert Ressler, who was an FBI special agent, criminal profiler, and author, interviewed Gacy and said, "He is responsible for far more homicides in many more locations throughout the country than those for which he was convicted. But the prosecutorial authorities in Illinois refuse to acknowledge this possibility." Quotation from his book, "I Have Lived in the Monster." Raphael Tovar, a former Des Plaines police officer who worked directly on the Gacy case, said, "I honestly believe that there are more victims, but where and how many, who knows?" And Joe Kozinczak, a former Des Plaines police lieutenant who was in charge of the case and had many conversations with the killer at the time, said, "I am convinced Gacy killed a lot more than 33 people. I think there are other victims out there, not only in Chicago, but other parts of the country." Possibility of accomplices. The first question that Gacy asked when he was arrested for murder was whether his associates had also been arrested. When police asked if they were directly or indirectly involved, he said, "Directly, they participated." In an interview, he said, "The media has always contended there were others involved. At the time of my arrest, there were four other suspects. Three of them worked for me." On death row, he named these associates: Michael Rossi, David Cram, Philip Paskey, and John Norman. Michael Rossi and David Cram were the two teenagers who worked for and lived with him after his divorce in 1976. Out of 33 victims, 13 died of asphyxiation and did not have a ligature around their neck. While some killers deviate from their MO, Gacy was so particular that it could be possible that he did not commit these murders, at least not by himself. three victims had gone missing while Gacy was out of town on business. Perhaps he had accomplices to lure boys to his home. When Robert Gilroy went missing and was murdered, Gacy was in Pittsburgh, which an Allegheny Airlines ticket confirmed. Gilroy disappeared on September 15, 1977, and Gacy was in Pittsburgh from the 12th to the 16th of December for work. Autopsy reports revealed that Gilroy had been suffocated and had cloth-like material stuffed in his throat, which deviated from Gacy's usual handcuff and rope trick. When Russell Nelson disappeared, he was last seen with a friend, Robert Young, who not only demanded money from his family to aid in his search, but also seemed to be linked to his disappearance, perhaps being paid to offer Gacy a new victim. Nelson also died of asphyxiation and not strangulation, and was found with a wad of cloth in his throat. The police had suggested that he could not have disappeared without his friend noticing. When Nelson's brothers went to look for their brother in Chicago themselves, they bumped into Robert Young, who immediately offered them jobs with PDM contractors. Interesting. John Mowry went missing shortly after 10 p.m. on September 25, 1977. However, Gacy was in Michigan by 6 a.m. the following morning, which would have left an impossibly small window of opportunity for him to abduct, torture, and murder this victim. Mowry was strangled and buried beneath his master bedroom. 3 days before he went missing, one of Gacy's associates had moved in with Mowry, which is strongly speculated to have been Michael Rossi. When some of Mowry's friends visited the apartment for more information, the roommate said that John had probably just gone on vacation. If that wasn't odd, he then asked them if they wanted to adopt John's dog, and spoke about a place where dozens of bodies were buried that no one, not even the police, knew about. A news interview with Mowry's two friends said that this roommate went on to commit other violent crimes in Chicago, and, unsurprisingly, Michael Rossi was arrested in 2003 and spent time in federal prison for a mass attack that he was involved in, where movie theaters between New York and Texas were smoke-bombed and set alight by a group of men. He has since been released and refuses to talk to anyone about anything. Two Chicago attorneys, Stephen Becker and Robert Stevenson, are convinced that some murders were not committed by Gacy himself, but rather by at least one accomplice. There is significant evidence out there that suggests that not only did John Wayne Gacy not operate alone, but he may not have been involved in some of the murders at all, and the fact that he was largely a copycat murderer, Stevenson said. Terry Sullivan, who was a prosecuting attorney on the case, agreed. I felt from the beginning that there may be loose ends. Cook County Sheriff Thomas Dart commented, I definitely would not dismiss what they have said. It's not out of left field. Jeffrey Rignall, one of Gacy's few survivors, was invited into the killer's car in March of 1978, where he was chloroformed and taken to his house. For several hours, he was tortured, raped, and abused, and while slipping in and out of consciousness, noticed that they were not alone in the house. He was adamant that he saw a young man with brown hair witness his abuse, and testified that at one point in the ordeal, a light in a different room of the house was switched on. Michael Rossi lived with Gacy from September 1976 to April 1977, and moved into an apartment owned by his father-in-law when he got married. However, when police approached Gacy for questioning in 1978, it was Rossi who answered the door, and who was frequently seen at the house late at night. He still worked for PDM at the time. When Gacy was under 24-hour surveillance in December 1978, police overheard him talking to Michael Rossi, who asked him, "And what, buried like the other five?" Keep in mind that Rossi was the one person who Gacy invited to go clowning with him, which would have been a massive honor in Gacy's view. He was obsessed with clowns, said clowns can get away with murder, enjoyed it therapeutically to regress back into childhood, and had an entire gallery of clown paintings and memorabilia in a special room in his house. If anyone were to be his accomplice, it would be someone he trusted to clown with him. Rossi was even allowed to use one of his clown personas, Patches, on several occasions, while Gacy was Pogo. John Syke was allegedly socializing with Michael Rossi at Gacy's house on the night that he was murdered, even though Gacy admitted that he was also there. He then bought Syke's car from Gacy, telling the police that he believed he left town. Sam Amarante, Gacy's defense attorney, does not believe that he could have had any accomplices, saying that if he did, he would not have confessed to all the murders in his office and that he would have played that card until his last minute to avoid the death penalty. However, what if his accomplice was so well connected and lawyered up that he was untouchable? Michael Rossi just so happens to be the grandson of Vito Marzulla, who was a powerful Chicago Democratic politician with connections to the Chicago outfit, the Mafia. When he was being interviewed by police, his mother walked into the police station and told them that if they did not release her son immediately, they would all be out of jobs the next day. With these influential connections, Gacy became a Democratic precinct captain in the 1970s, which is what earned him the opportunity to meet First Lady Rosalynn Carter on May 6, 1978, at Chicago's annual Polish Constitution Day parade. In the picture with her, he is featured wearing an S-pin, which meant that he was given special clearance. This became a U.S. Secret Service embarrassment once Gacy was arrested just 7 months later, becoming one of America's most prolific serial killers in history. How did he get this special clearance? Connections? What is Gacy's connection to John Norman and Philip Paskey? Philip Paskey was a confirmed associate of John Norman, the man who operated countrywide sex trafficking rings out of Texas, known as the Odyssey Foundation and the Delta Project. He was arrested several times for sexual assault and being in possession of and distributing child pornography, and had met Paskey in the Cook County Jail while they were both serving time. Each time that he was released, he moved his business to a new location and picked up right where he left off. One of these locations was Illinois, and his residence was surprisingly close to the location where two of Gacy's victims, Kenneth Parker and Michael Marino, whose remains were not a DNA match to their families, were abducted from. Marino's mother has never stopped looking for her son, believing that he was sex trafficked and could still be alive. When Norman's apartment was raided in August 1973, police found between 5,000 and 30,000 index cards containing the names of his clients, which were predominantly from California, Dallas, and Illinois, but suspected of extending internationally. They paid him to be supplied with adolescents and mostly young boys. The cards were immediately destroyed by the State Department of Texas following his arrest. Allegedly, politicians, doctors, dentists, and high-level members of society were on the list, and the scale and success of Norman's business could not be measured. In 1977, the child pornography ring was exposed in the media, naming Norman as the leader. However, he was released after serving 4 years in jail when a witness in the case was found murdered. He was arrested several more times for the same activities after this, each time entering plea deals and arrangements to spend minimal time in prison. He died in 2009 at the age of 82 and was known as a violent sexual predator who showed no remorse for any of his activities. How was John Wayne Gacy connected to John Norman? Police had found three PDM checks signed by Gacy and addressed to Philip Paskey for undisclosed services in 1978. It is also suspected that the person who connected Gacy to Paskey was David Cram. Dean Carl, the serial killer who Gacy admired and copycatted, was also one of Norman's clients. Gacy was a prominent member of his community, the leader of the local Jaycees, a Democratic precinct captain, and someone who operated his home like a dormitory for teenage boys. Would it be such a speculative stretch to assume that his connections and activities expanded beyond his crawl space? One former PDM employee turned out to become a prolific serial killer who formed part of the gang known as the Chicago Rippers. His name was Robin Gecht. The group were a satanic cult and organized crime group who murdered, mutilated, and cannibalized 18 women in Illinois between 1981 and 1982. Gecht was known as a rapist, serial killer, and necrophile, much like Gacy. Gecht had always pled his innocence, receiving a 120-year sentence for the kidnapping, rape, and manslaughter of their final victim, and was taken to Menard Correctional Facility, where Gacy had spent his last 14 years on death row. Robin's son eventually also ended up in prison for first-degree murder. Had Gacy trained these boys, or been connected to them for several years because of similar interests? It seems so. Philip Paskey died in 1998. David Cram committed suicide in 2001. John Norman died in 2009, which leaves only Michael Rossi alive today, who refuses to speak with anyone about anything relating to the case. Gacy was guilty of serial rape and murder. The only question that remains is, did he have any help?